Hello and welcome to Table Talk. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
Today we are joined by John Attashrew, who is the head chef of the Tate Modern. Alongside the seasonal a la carte that the restaurant serves, John curates menus based around the gallery's exhibitions. And this morning we're delighted to be talking to him ahead of the forthcoming Andy Warhol exhibition, for which a 9-course menu has been created. John, welcome to Table Talk.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We'll start where we always start, which is at the beginning. What was food like when you were growing up?
Well, my dad had one dish. I think he called it a Persian omelette. So you take tomatoes, you fry them in butter, an obscene amount of butter, you throw some chili in there, and then when it's kind of getting all pretty smushed up, you crack a few eggs, and then you serve it with kind of burnt bread. It's amazing on a hangover. But my mum's a great cook. My mum, so my background, my dad's from Iran, and my mum's English, and we grew up eating a lot of Persian food. So I was probably eating rice maybe 6 nights a week.
Okay.
Yeah, a roast dinner on a Sunday. That was always looked forward to. But then, you know, we had a nice variety of food through the week. My mum was a full-time working mum, but then she cooked a lot. I don't really know how she found time to do it. I think it's because she probably didn't sleep. But a lot of Persian cuisine, a lot of rice, you know, and the occasional curry.
Was your parents cooking something you were interested in from an early age, or was it just part of the scenery?
I think it was probably part of the scenery. I don't really remember actively being involved. I think it was more like I'd be given broad beans that I needed to peel or something like that to kind of help out for one of the Persian dishes. But it wasn't like I was coming in and cooking.
And you weren't on a stool next to her apron strings?
No, I think one of the first things I learned how to make was tzatziki, and then I got charged with doing that whenever we had like a barbecue or something, like something summery. I got charged with making that, and then I got charged with making starters at Christmas time for, you know, Christmas dinner.
What would you make?
Oh, prawn cocktail.
Perfect.
Something, you know.
Classic.
Persian dish.
Yeah, exactly, that classic Persian thing. Well, my mum was quite, like, I think fastidious about Christmas was always going to be Christmas. I mean, we'd have so much like spice and like different food that like my dad, I guess, really liked. And it was really nice because you get a lot of my family visit from Iran, and you get these kind of old biddy Iranian ladies coming over. And then there was this white lady from Stoke that could cook better Persian food than them. And you could see it really grated on them.
Where did she learn it from?
My dad criticising.
Right, perfect. Yeah.
I think my grandmother gave her some recipes and did some teaching and stuff when she visited, which was kind of infrequently through my childhood.
Would she have gone back to Iran?
Yeah.
She was learning there as well.
Oh, no, my mum first visited Iran like recently, so it was just from my mother and my grandmother visiting from Iran.
Did you ever go as a child?
No, we didn't go as when we were small, and then there's this whole kind of potential conscription issue once I turned 18, so I just lay low, stay here.
Yes.
And what about school food? I mean, do you have happy memories of what you were eating then?
No, not so much. Yeah, it was the odd packed lunch, kind of slightly dry peanut butter sandwiches. I think by the time I got to 16, we were in kind of secondary, and then it was, I think my mum used to give me money for like getting a sandwich down like the shop in the village, and then I don't know, they knew me in the sandwich shop because I'd be like a guy that would be like, I want this with that, and I'd like come out some like strange concoctions. But like they were always great. Like,
yeah.
I mean I would make sure my lunchtime I'm sitting down, I've got like space in the common room, I've gone to the bathroom, you can't eat before you've been, you know, if you need to go to the toilet, you have everything ready, and then you enjoy your nice sandwich. That was kind of like my little, I guess, routine every day.
It sounds like you ate as a family when you were growing up. Were mealtimes a big deal?
Yeah, we always ate as a family. I think my dad was always quite late from work, so our dinner was always pushed quite late. I think whenever I visited family or friends, we would eat at like 6 or 6.30. But if I was at home, it was always like 8.30, 9 o'clock, because we'd be waiting for my dad to come back from work. And that's always been normal for me, but I think that's not that normal in England.
Yeah, and I suppose there is often the case of children eating earlier and then parents eating separately.
Yeah, we would normally eat the same thing. Yeah, I think my mum would cook once. There wouldn't be any like different meals with the kids.
And when was it that you started to develop an interest in food? I mean, judging from your sandwiches, clearly you were very kind of particular about it, but when did you...
You know, when you look back, you kind of see lots of little blips, and you're like, oh, that must have been something. Like, I remember telling my mum off for not putting all the rice out with our meal, because then it would go cold. And like, as like a little kid, it seemed quite strange looking back on that. You think about that, like, yeah. I want my rice hot throughout the meal.
But at the time, you just wanted hot rice.
At the time, I just wanted my rice hot. But actually thinking about it, like, that was quite a strange thing for a little kid to ask.
Yeah.
I think there's one probably kind of defining moment, I think, for me. I was at uni studying for an economics degree, and I decided that I was going to spend my evening building a proving box over my radiator in halls whilst everyone else went out and got pissed.
Amazing.
And everyone came back at about 11:30, hammered. And I'd just taken fresh bread out of this little box oven in our little student kitchen, worst oven in the world. And we sat on the floor in the like hallway area, about nine of us eating bread and butter at like midnight. And it was great. And I thought, right, I quite like doing this.
God, I wish you'd lived near me in halls. So when did you think... I might want to do this professionally. I mean, you're studying for an economics degree at UCL at this point.
Well, I did some kind of evening classes. I dabbled, I experimented. And then my uncle knew the head chef at a Michelin-starred restaurant called The Aubergine in Chelsea. And so he hooked me up with an interview. So I kind of went down and just said, I know nothing about professional cooking. Can I just come and work here and like see what it's like over my summer? So that was fine. I went down there, I think it was meant to be for a couple of weeks. And I was there for 2 months doing full hours. I mean, I didn't get paid anything, but it was more about just the experience of doing it. And I loved it. My family were quite abhorrent with the idea. I found out later, it was only a couple of years ago, I found out that they'd actually sent me down there thinking, he's going to have a look at this. This is so much hard work. He's going to give up and go, right, we'll be an accountant like a good Iranian boy. And
it didn't work. It totally flopped.
So then I asked the head chef, I'm like, right, so I want to do this. Do I need to go to catering college or what? And he said, right, you go back to uni, you finish, and then when you're done, you come and see me and I'll give you a job. And that's what happened.
And am I right in thinking he then specialised in pastry? Was that at Aubergine or was that afterwards?
It was there and my next restaurant as well. I worked in pastry for about 4 years out of about 13 I've been cooking now. I think that's quite odd, generally. I think most chefs either do hot kitchen or they do pastry. They don't do a bit of both.
Was it just accident or was it by design that you ended up doing pastry?
I think I was put there just because I was relatively junior. Oh, I knew nothing. And they're like, there's always two people on pastry. So then you've got someone leading and someone teaching. But generally, like Billy's approach back then was everybody has to do every section. And a good place to start is pastry because you learn how to follow a recipe.
Yes.
And then once you can do that, then you can work another section.
And did you enjoy pastry?
Oh, I love it. I'd say even now, like pastry is probably my favourite section to actually work. I do everything. There are very few jobs I don't enjoy doing. But pastry, has a special place for me.
What is it about pastry?
It's safety in numbers. You follow the numbers, everything works.
Yeah.
And it doesn't go wrong. There's no kind of room for error. It's just you follow the numbers and it works. And I guess that's having a maths background. Yeah. Then that helps.
And after the Aubergine, where did you then move on to?
Then I was at a restaurant called Hibiscus in Mayfair. That was intense, to say the least. That was a 2-Michelin-star restaurant pushing for 3 stars with a very talented but very crazy head chef. The food was amazing, but the hours were really long. That was hard. That was like probably the hardest like working time in my life.
Is there a particular pressure that comes with working in a Michelin-starred restaurant?
Oh, yeah. It's people that haven't worked, even chefs that are like, oh, I'm going to try working in Michelin, they don't understand the level of detail and precision that's just constantly required. There isn't any There's no slacking. There's no like off time. There's no it's good enough. It's every single time everything's got to be at this like level. And especially when you're two star pushing to three, then it's even more so.
And how did you end up at the Tate?
Well, after 9-10 years of cooking in various places, I got married. And I think it got to a point where my wife has said before we got married, if I don't find a job where the working hours are reasonable, she's going to leave me. So the Tate opportunity came up and I went for it, really.
And how does it differ from the other kitchens you've been in?
Well, I'd say it's quite a big difference, to be fair. The working hours are a lot more reasonable. I would say family-friendly, because we're only open the hours that the gallery is open.
Right.
So, what is it, Sunday through Thursday is only a daytime shift, and then we're only open for lunch and dinner on Fridays and Saturdays. So it just means your life is so much more balanced as a chef. I think previously, my job before, I was working five doubles.
Wow.
And then...
Doesn't make for good family life.
Not really, no. And, you know, we've got a little son, and he's amazing. And I get to go home and, like, do bedtime and have dinner with him. I wouldn't be able to do that if I didn't work somewhere that offered me, like, reasonable hours.
Let's talk about the menus, because as well as the Warhol one, which we'll come on to, you've also created ones for Oliver Ellison and the Picasso exhibition. I mean, how do you go about creating a menu that ties in with the big blockbuster exhibition?
Well, I mean, it comes down to research, really. I guess research and experience. Looking at Picasso, that was the first one we did. It started off with a little bit of kind of online research, but that yielded a little bit, but not so much. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of recipes that Picasso himself had kind of given out. They were interesting. They worked, but they needed tweaking to make it more like restaurant food.
Yeah. What sort of thing was he?
Well, his big one was this egg tortilla.
Oh.
And whilst we stayed true to his recipe, I added a lot more of extra egg yolks to kind of enrich it and give it this kind of just richness to the dish that it was kind of lacking. And then I had some ways of presenting it just to make it look a bit more restauranty rather than just like a home thing. But then that led, I still had another load of dishes to write, so that led me to, I found a book in the British Library that kind of actually followed his life through food. And then I was managed to strip out some of the dishes from there, again juice them up a little bit for a restaurant scene, and that whole menu worked really well.
And for the Eliasson, you went on a research trip to Berlin, is that right?
Yeah, so they put me up in the Eliasson studio for just under a week. Mm-hmm. So I was there. They have a kitchen actually in the studio where they're big into collaboration. So how they work their kitchen is they have a local farm that they source the majority of their produce from. Everything is vegetarian or vegan. And they have a kitchen team of three or four that basically produce everything that the staff there eat. So once a day, around 120 people come and sit down in this canteen and get a freshly cooked vegetarian meal.
It's fantastic.
It's lovely. And it's really nice, honest, simple cooking. And it's obviously very produce-led. Mm. And there's a lot of thought that goes into it. And then they do lots of little kind of extra things, like they make kombucha, they make miso, they have all these extra little projects that they then try and involve the gallery, or sorry, the rest of the studio in. And then the studio is also has built the kitchen, like they do everything in-house, so they've built this whole studio from like wood workshop and their metal workshop, and then they've then built the kitchen, they built the tables, they built the benches.
Wow.
So everything is like linked as part of it.
And was the Eliasson the first menu that you'd created alongside an exhibition?
No, so it went Picasso first.
A Picasso.
Then I did Bonnard.
Ah.
And then Eliasson was next.
And so the Picasso is the first one. Where did the idea come about for this, not quite collaboration, but linked curated menu?
Honestly, I don't know. I'd recently taken over as head chef, so I was working there as the senior sous before. And I'd recently taken over as head chef, and then we knew Picasso was coming, and we know what shows are coming up quite a few years ahead, actually. And we wanted to do some promotion for the restaurant. So I'm like, right, can you write a menu that is to do with Picasso?
Amazing.
And it was a bit of a kind of shot in the dark. And I'm a bit 0-100%. So I was like, right, if we're going to do this, we're going to do this properly. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of manic research mm-hmm. to get everything and find out all the little details. And then each little dish accompanied like a little story about the dish itself or the reason behind it. And I think that's really lends weight to it. Otherwise, it's a plate of food that kind of might have something to do with them, but it's the story that brings it all together.
And how about the Warhol? I mean, how have you gone about researching that?
Warhol's probably been, because I guess he's a bit more recent than Picasso. There's a lot more available online. There's a lot more kind of quotes and ideas. I mean, in terms of this menu, will be more of a snacking menu. So there'll be lots of little things that he had, and then some things he had and some things he wouldn't have eaten.
Because he famously didn't eat a lot and was quite fussy.
It was more, he was obsessed with sugar.
He didn't like savoury, is that right?
Didn't, but then he felt the social pressure that he should eat, and he should eat savoury. So we've kind of got, I've got a menu that, of things that he would have ordered, or would have been seen to be enjoying, but not actually eaten.
Right.
And then we've got a sweet menu of things he would have totally pigged out on.
Some of these dishes sound, I won't need to explain them to us. This is the tuna fish disaster and caviar with the shawl. What's going on with those two?
Okay, well, so tuna fish disaster, he has a piece of the same name where two ladies died from eating a tainted can of tuna. And I don't know, the name sprung out at me. It just made me think of messing up a plate. So it's this nice refined piece of tuna with like a tuna-laden mayonnaise that's just exploded on the plate. It's kind of just trying to make a mess and create a disaster, so to speak, on the plate. Caviar with the Shah comes out of his work basically to get money. He would do a lot of portraiture for famous people because they would pay out really well. So he was courting the Shah of Iran to do, I think, a portraiture of him and the family. And this meant attending a lot of meetings at the embassy. And supposedly every time he went, the portion of caviar served was diminishing as the Shah's power waned before the revolution. And that's where the kind of dish came from. So it's the idea of smalling, shrinking portions of caviar on a plate.
And the sweet dishes that you have on the menu are, I suppose, using slightly trashier ingredients. So you've got a Coca-Cola one and one that uses cereal milk, and there's the one with that I believe has condensed tomato soup in it, is that right?
Yes, so the idea, yeah, we've got one which is called Bringing Home the Bacon Ice Cream. The Warhol canned tomato soup is quite one of these iconic images, and I like this idea of doing a sweet bacon ice cream with tomato soup. Sounds weird, I know. Sounds totally, it works.
It works.
But it took a lot of playing to get it right. But again, that comes back to the story of he was a poor immigrant child. He grew up with not a lot. And he was asked in later life, like, why are you still working like a maniac? Like, he was non-stop to the end, producing and working. And he was quoted often, time and time again, that he had to bring home the bacon. So that just set a light off in my brain and was like, right, bringing home the bacon, ice cream. And then the sauce became like a natural accompaniment for that, because bacon and tomato we know works. So then there's got to be a way of making that into a sweet.
Mm.
Personally, I quite like the Mars cake.
Oh yeah, that sounds fantastic.
Again, I think it just comes down to experience really, because there's a story of him describing cake as a child, where you just get a chocolate bar, you stick it between two pieces of bread and you eat it.
And that's a cake.
That's a cake. But in my mind, that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
Because actually what I've got is, I've got chocolate brioche soaked with a custard, cooked off like French toast, with Mars bar in the middle.
I mean, how can you go wrong?
I mean that's the same principle, just taken with some technique to another level. And that's, you know, that's basically what I try and do.
all the dishes are clearly supposed to like delight and excite and inspire, but there must be different practicalities for you cooking in a museum restaurant, a gallery restaurant, sorry, rather than, say, a Michelin-starred restaurant or one where you're doing a nine-course tasting menu. How does it work logistically for you with the gallery?
I mean, it presents its own challenges, especially the restaurant is situated quite far away from the loading bay, so, you know, it can be a logistical challenge physically getting all our products upstairs on time. In terms of service, we have to think about how we design the menu so that it can fit and be able to send it out for 150, 200 people. If I can't send that menu, that's because I haven't done my job right. Like, I've worked to Tate long enough that I know the constraints of the building and the constraints of my kitchen, because it's not a big kitchen. It's a really small kitchen for the size of the restaurant we have. But yeah, that is my job, to make sure it's designed in a way that's appropriate, that we can build it and we can send it, and it's going to be consistent and tasty and deliverable all the time.
And how important is food for a museum or gallery these days? I mean, there's a row that's broken out this week at the Tate about this new head of coffee roll, Grayson Perry accusing the Tate of paying the head of coffee more than they'd be paying their curators. I mean, do you think people are now coming more for the kind of experience of having a good meal at a museum?
I think there's a couple of things. I must say, I don't really know anything about the coffee issue that's come out yesterday. My head's generally quite focused in the kitchen. I stay off social media quite a lot, really.
Sounds healthy.
Very sensible.
Yeah. But I mean, in terms of food in the gallery, there's probably a few things to look at. One is, it's another revenue stream for the arts, where, you know, in the number of years we've had austerity, government funding has cut back, and so finding a way of making it another source of income for the gallery is really important to keep the arts accessible and free. The other side of it is, we want people to enjoy the experience. So if we've got the Picasso exhibition on or the Warhol exhibition on, and people don't just walk around, look at some images and then leave, we can actually bring them a whole nother level of kind of value. I think tying those two things in together is really important.
And what about cooking at home? Do you have time to cook at home nowadays?
Yeah, like my mum, I don't sleep. So, yeah, I generally try and batch cook when I'm on my days off, or in my evenings I'll batch cook up stuff for my wife and my son for the week. And then if I'm not there, it's easy reheatable stuff for them, so they're all...
And what sort of thing will you be cooking?
Well, little man loves mac and cheese. That's always a firm favourite. We do lots of fresh pasta things. Curries go down well because they store really nicely. Yeah. Generally lots of things with rice. I guess that's going back to my heritage. Yeah, that's about it.
And do you have a sweet tooth? Do you like pudding?
I do. I think it's an Iranian trait that I just love sugar. My dad used to buy the amount of fruit that man goes through, even now. Like, he'll get a crate. Like, we'll go down, it'll be some nice cherries. He'll buy the box. Sharon fruit, box. Everything by box. Like, it won't be a handful. It won't. And he'll go through all of it. I don't understand where it goes. And then there's Persian cakes, biscuits, and then, like, the tea they have, the traditional Persian tea. You take a sugar cube, you put it between your teeth, and then you drink the tea through the sugar cube. So, yeah, I love sugar, but I'm really trying to limit how much I have, because otherwise I'd be the size of a whale.
And what is your desert island dish?
Oh, one dish.
One dish. Well, I might waive the rules if you can persuade me.
I think it would probably be this chicken coriander curry that my mum used to make. It works so well. You know, it's one of those things that you open the door, you smell it, and you just start salivating straight away. You're like, oh, it's today. I mean, you know, there's different things for, like, if you're talking like comfort food or things that I always go back to, you know, soups are probably my favourite thing. But yeah, in terms of desert island, then yeah, it'd probably be that chicken and
coriander. Chicken curry.
Yeah.
That sounds great. John, thank you so much for joining Table Talk. And if you'd like to try the Andy Warhol menu, it's available at the Tate Modern from the 12th of March this year.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.
so difficile.